Good evening, and welcome to Behind the News for August 15, 2002. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And we've got, unusually for this show, just one guest lined up for tonight. Sitting here in the studio is Joseph Stiglitz, author of Globalization and Its Discontents, co-winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics for last year, and one of the most distinguished economists of his generation, professor at Columbia University, will join us and talk about his book and his experience in the Clinton administration at the World Bank and in very productive exile since then. But before we get to him, a couple of observations on the state of the ever-evolving state of the U.S. economy. First of all, earlier this week, I guess it was Monday, marked the 20th anniversary of the low in the stock market. Tuesday, August 13, marked the beginning of a 18-year great bull market, one of the great bull markets in human history, which ended sometime in 2000. But 20 years ago, it was all just beginning. Then earlier this week, the Federal Reserve decided to leave interest rates unchanged, but in its statement said that the risks in the economy now were towards weakness, which was a moderately generous thing to do. But the economic data that's come out this week has not been stunning in its strength. The Federal Reserve's Index of Industrial Production released this morning was positive, but just barely so, and the Philadelphia Fed's survey of manufacturing in the Mid-Atlantic region came in rather negatively, surprising everyone to the downside. And employment, the employment component of the Philly Fed survey was very weak, suggesting that manufacturing employment is still contracting. So not too much good news on the U.S. economic front this week. We'll see what comes in coming weeks, but it's not, it's just not, not recovering like it's supposed to. It's almost like the early 90s all over again. We've got a Bush in the White House. We're about to go to war with Iraq, and the recovery is jobless, and the president's poll numbers are slipping. So it looks like that old W is going to have to wag the dog if he wants to get those poll numbers back up. And now, let's turn to the guest for this evening, Joseph Stiglitz, who is the author most recently of Globalization and Its Discontents. He shared the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2001 for, among other things, the development of information economics, and we'll ask him to talk about that in a little bit later. And he's a professor at Columbia University here in New York City, and widely seen as one of the leading economists of his generation. Welcome to our studio, Joseph Stiglitz.
Nice to be here.
It's funny, Globalization is Discontents bears no relation to a book of the same title by Saskia Sassen that the New Press published a couple of years ago. And I guess we all keep stealing from Freud in variations on its discontents. Well, let me start just by asking your evaluation of the U.S. economy right now, before we get to your book and your experience at the World Bank. By some measures, we still have a very overvalued stock market in the U.S. despite the bear market of the last couple of years. We have a chronic large trade deficit, growing foreign debts. If the United States were a smaller country, you'd almost think it was ready for a structural adjustment program. What do you see for the U.S. economy going forward from here?
Well, I think the situation is not good. A year ago, there were two problems facing the U.S. economy, an investment overhang and clear indications that there would be inventory decumulation. The process of inventory decumulation has wended its way. In the first quarter of this year, that was reversed. And that's why we got a little bit of growth in the first quarter of this year. But it was all temporary. Anybody looking at the underlying fundamentals of the economy saw that there was still this overhang of investment. And there were some fundamental other problems, some of which you've already mentioned. You mentioned the fact that we have this large trade deficit. The result of this large trade deficit is the United States is becoming increasingly indebted abroad. There are other problems that have recently come to light, which I discussed, which I was concerned to me back in 93, 94 when I was working in the White House. The accounting frameworks that really have led to America not having confidence in the numbers were problems that we were aware of. And the FASB, the Financial Accounting Standards Board, wanted to do something about it. But pressure was brought to bear from Wall Street, from the U.S. Treasury, to try to keep the old accounting practices, not have stock options reported in the way they ought to be. That provided incentives for corporations to blow up their stock numbers, because the higher the numbers got, the higher the rewards for the executives. And some of the long-standing walls between commercial and investment banks, walls that have been erected in the last great economic in the Great Depression under the Glass-Steagall Act, those were taken down again under pressure from the financial markets. U.S. Treasury played a critical role. And now we've seen problems in the credibility of the kind of advice that people like Merrill Lynch provide, some of the practices that have been engaged in. The net result of this is that the credibility of the stock market has been undermined. So even if there had not been a problem of overvaluation, the problems of the stock market, we would be facing serious problems in the stock market today. This feeds in, then, as the stock market erodes, people are beginning to realize that they have thought they had a lot of wealth saved for the retirement, and that wealth has just disappeared overnight. And that's going to mean that the consumption binge, which America has been enjoying, is likely to come to an end. Consumption was the strength of the economy through the year 2001, the beginning of 2002. I think there is every reason to believe that it will not have quite the strength going forward. And with weak investment, because the investment overhang, weak consumption, and the other problems that we mentioned, the rising U.S. deficit, huge turnaround in a very short span of time, means that there's a lot of uncertainty about the whole political context, the economic context. It was Clinton deficit reduction restored confidence to the country and to the markets that the fiscal house was in order, and now that's been reversed. So there are an awful lot of reasons for one to have skepticism about where the economy is going.
Now, one of the things you're most famous for as an economist is information theory and information asymmetries. That is, two parties to a transaction aren't equally well informed, don't have the same knowledge. The classic example being a company that sells stock. You buy stock in it, you don't know whether what the prospects of the company are. The managers probably know better than whoever buys the stock. What in this situation where we know now that the accounts are were systematically dishonest, in many cases, or severely buffed up in less severe cases. What's the impact of this over the long term? Is this easily gotten over?
Well, the impact is very negative, because one of the reasons why we worry about accurate information is that prices are determined on the basis of that information. And investment decisions, in turn, depend on prices. So if people thought profits were larger than they really were, prices in the stock market will be higher than they ought to have been. Higher prices, investment. There'll be more investment, say, in telecommunications than there should have been. And that contributed to the overinvestment in so many areas that now represent the overhang that we're facing. So the problems we're facing today, in no small measure, are related to these problems of information.
And is there any way to fix this? Or is this going to take time to heal?
It is going to take time to heal, but we have to recognize the underlying source of the problem so we won't repeat the problem or not repeat it to the same extent. The underlying problem was an accounting framework that both itself provided unreliable information and, even worse, provided incentives for CEOs to provide unreliable information. And then more broadly, an accounting profession making more money from consulting than providing accurate accounts that also had a conflict of interest, and then financial markets that also had conflicts of interest. So all of these piled on top of each other to make a situation that was bad even worse.
And do you have any sense that the folks in charge in Washington have any grasp of the problem or any idea what to do about it?
No, I don't think they do. I think some people do, like Senator Sarbanes, who's been pushing these ideas for concern for a long time. Yes, he has a good grasp. But it was only public pressure that finally got Bush to change his position. Initially, he didn't want to do anything about the stock option issue. And many people, other people in Congress, do not want to do anything about the stock option issue. I think now there's enough force that something will happen. But the other issues, for instance, the conflicts of interest between commercial and investment banks, I see no intimation that anything is going to be done about that. Wall Street viewed as a great victory when those two groups of banks were allowed to merge together. They said, don't worry, we'll create Chinese walls so we won't have these conflicts of interest. These Chinese walls don't look quite so strong as they were alleged to have been.
They seem rather porous now, it seems. I'm speaking with Joseph Stiglitz, who is the author of Globalization and Its Discontents and winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics for last year and teaches at Columbia University. You earlier mentioned the influence of Wall Street operating through the U.S. Treasury on policy. For example, the repeal of Glass-Steagall, breaking down the barriers between commercial and investment banking. Now, of course, the former Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin is now co-chair of Citigroup, which is one of the entities that was created by the demise of Glass-Steagall. Not to be so crude as to assume this was a quid pro quo for Treasury's support of repeal of Glass-Steagall. Just how does this influence work? I mean, why is the Treasury Wall Street's conduit to the executive branch?
Well, every agency within the government has a natural constituency. It's very natural that the Labor Department listens to, talks with the unions and labor constituencies, at least under most administrations. And so it's quite natural that Treasury, which see as part of its constituency the concerns of financial markets, the concerns of Wall Street. The real problem is when what is a natural constituency, a voice, becomes dominant. And one of the things I point out in my book, Globalization and Its Discontents, is the fact that it began to become an active advocate for those interests, even in situations where clearly America's broader interests were being put into jeopardy. Let me give you an example. One of the things that some groups within Wall Street were very interested in was capital market liberalization. That is to say, opening up markets abroad to American speculators, opening up markets abroad to the kinds of products that Wall Street sells. For them, this was just another aspect of trade opening. But in the developing countries, this kind of capital market liberalization, as it's called, opening yourself up to speculative capital flows, can be very destabilizing. And the problem in our world that we have today with close integration is that problems in one country spill over into problems of others. So when the U.S. Treasury pushed capital market liberalization on Korea, for instance, in 1993-94, it was just a short while later in 1997 when the consequences were felt not only by Korea, but the whole world. And by 1998, we were facing a global financial crisis, one in which America and European financial interests were at risk.
Your Columbia colleague, Jagdish Bhagwati, argues that he's a passionate free trader, but argues that people have sort of extrapolated, made the analogy that free capital movements is kind of like free trade and also virtuous. He says they're very, very different things, that free trade, good, free capital movement, not necessarily good. Do you share that point of view?
Yes, and I think most people who understand capital markets also share that view. The point is that capital markets are very different. And in fact, capital markets are concerned with information. And so the analysis of capital markets has been one of the primary foci of my research over the last 30 years. Let me give you an example to show you the difference between the two. Consider what happens in a small developing country, say in Africa, when it opens up its capital markets freely to foreign capital. A company in the country borrows, say, $100 million from an American bank. Well, the standards of prudence now require that country to set aside $100 million because it recognizes that American bank can demand the dollars back at any time, and it has to have those dollars in reserves. With $100 million set aside for reserves, think about what this means for the economy, this poor African economy as a whole. It's borrowing $100 million from America, paying, say, 18-20% interest. How does it hold those reserves in U.S. Treasury bills, T-bills? In effect, it's lending to the United States. But what interest rate is it getting on the money that it's lending? About 2% today, less than 2%. So the net amounts received by the country is zero. It gets $100 million from the United States. It lends $100 million to the United States. Can't help economic growth. But think about it. It's even worse than that. Because on the $100 million that it lends the United States, it gets 2%. On the $100 million it borrows from the United States, it's paying 18 or 20%. It means the net flow of funds from this poor African country is somewhere between $16 and $18 million a year. It's good for the United States, it's good for the U.S. Treasury, but it's not good for that poor African country.
Well, but suppose the poor country could take the money, the $100 million, and invest it in an agricultural product or a factory or something like that. Wouldn't it then have the money to service the debt?
If it didn't have to put that money in reserves, it could then use that money to invest in education projects, to invest in factories, could do 101 things that would yield a far higher return than the 2% it gets in U.S. Treasury bills. But the point is that with capital market liberalization, it's forced to put that money into U.S. Treasury bills.
It's a good deal for the U.S. Treasury, then.
Very good deal. And you can understand why they might support this kind of financial market arrangement.
Now, let's fast forward to your time at the World Bank. You went from the Clinton administration on the Council of Economic Advisors to become chief economist of the World Bank and entered a world you probably hadn't seen up close before, although you'd studied development economics, but you hadn't been really deeply inside these institutions. Was it a surprise to you when you finally got there?
Well, not completely. I mean, I had done work as a consultant at the World Bank for many, many years. In fact, I had participated in one of the most exciting projects at the World Bank, that studying the East Asia miracle. Remember, East Asia was the one region in the world where we had successful development. And Japan asked a very interesting question. It said, since East Asia is the region that's had the most success in development, don't you think you ought to study East Asia to see what lessons you could learn? And the World Bank's research department at first said, or the World Bank said, we know the answers. Why study you? And then they said, we don't have the money. And so Japan responded and said, we'll give you the money, but we want you to also hire some outside consultants. And there were a number of us that did the project, participated in the project. And very interestingly, we came up with a view quite strongly that, yes, East Asia was very successful, but they had followed markedly different policies than the Washington Consensus policies. Yes, like the Washington Consensus policy, the kinds of policies that the IMF and the World Bank had pushed, they had very stable macro policies, but they had not engaged in rapid liberalization, rapid privatization. In fact, the government was very active in the case of Korea, building one of the most efficient steel mills in the world. So they had a much more activist government, much different set of policies, and much more successful than any of the policies that the IMF had advocated. The interesting thing is, at the World Bank, they began to rethink the economic policies that they were recommending.
Now, that report was sort of watered down as it went through the editing process, wasn't it?
It was watered down, but it began a process of rethinking. Mm-hmm. So the fact that there were these political pressures to water things down, I had seen firsthand. But I also saw how it was beginning to change thinking at the World Bank.
And that was when Lawrence Summers was chief economist at the World Bank?
That's right. That's when it began. But by the time the study had come out, he had moved on.
Uh-huh. Then to the Treasury Department?
That's right. But what was really striking to me when I came to the World Bank was to see the adverse impact on development and on stability that the IMF was exercising around the world. And in the book, I describe one of the most dramatic, traumatic, I almost say, experiences I had was when just a month after I came to the World Bank, I went down to Ethiopia, which is one of the poorest countries in the world. And here was a country that had a balanced budget, no inflation. In fact, prices were falling. Had rapid growth for 5 years since the current government had overthrown one of the worst Marxist regimes in the world. A government that had, because of its commitment to development of the poor, development of the rural sector, had cut back on defense expenditures from 6% to 2%, even though it had come to power through military means. This is a really unusual government, a government in which one didn't hear any charges of corruption, and yet the IMF had suspended the program. And I asked a simple question, why? And the answer I was told is the budget wasn't in balance. And I looked at the budget, and it was in balance. And they said, but you shouldn't include foreign aid. But I said, well, you know, why else are governments like Sweden and UK giving money if it's not for the governments, for the Ethiopian government to spend money to build schools and hospitals? And they said, you can't rely on it. The Ethiopian government had a very, very good answer. They said, look, as long as we get the money, we'll build the schools. And when we don't get the money, we'll stop building the schools. Well, these are not projects that are, you know, 10, 15-year projects. These are low-cost schools that take a few months, 6 months to build. And when that money stops, they'll stop building it. In fact, when we came back to Washington, we did a study, and we showed that tax revenues were more unstable than foreign aid. So under the IMF logic, you shouldn't include either tax revenue or foreign aid, in which case, of course, every government is in trouble. And then in a very emotional discussion I had with the prime minister, he said, you know, look, he hadn't fought for 17 years to overthrow one of the worst governments in the world, to be told by some international bureaucrats on the basis of really bad economic analysis that he couldn't build schools for the poor children, couldn't build health clinics for people with disease if he could succeed in getting money from foreign governments to build those. And I had to say I agreed with them. And it was this mindset of the IMF, which still has not fully changed. You know, we worked for years to change that policy, and they've made a little bit of movement. But, you know, it's been 5 years.
I want to get back to the mindset of the IMF in just a moment. But economist Rudy Dornbush, who died recently, said a couple of provocative things during the Asian crisis a few years ago. One was, I saw this on CNBC myself, he said the good side of the Asian crisis was that South Korea is now a wholly owned subsidiary of the U.S. Treasury. And he said about that time also, I think it was quoted in the Journal of Commerce, as saying the IMF is a toy of the U.S. to pursue its economic policy offshore. This paints a picture of the IMF as really run by the U.S. Treasury for basically U.S. interests. Is he exaggerating, or is that a fair picture?
It is a remarkably accurate picture. Things are more complex. It's a multinational institution which everybody has a voice. But the U.S. is the only country that has a veto power. You know, at the U.N., there's complaints about five countries determined by historical accident having the veto power. In the U.S., in the IMF, it's only one country. In the case of Korea, the transparency of the U.S. dictation of the policy was amazing. The undersecretary of the U.S. Treasury was in the hotel in Seoul as the agreement was being reached. And, you know, every night the IMF would go up to his room and check to see whether, in fact, it met the approval. As a result of that, the IMF team did not have time to consult the World Bank team, which had enormous experience with Korea. These, you know, the IMF team flew in, didn't know very much about the country, whereas the World Bank team had years of experience working in the country. And yet there was no interest in really discussing using that kind of experience. But they said, well, we were too busy to talk to the World Bank, even though the World Bank wound up putting lending $10 billion. But that wasn't enough for the World Bank to have any significant voice in the negotiations.
I remember at the time, a World Bank person was quoted in the Washington Post as saying they're viewing us as an ATM for this project, but not much else.
That's right.
All right. Well, let's take a little break, and we'll be back in just a moment to speak some more with Joseph Stiglitz.
We've all got opinions. Where do they come from?
Distant thunder from the east. Won't disturb our morning
dawn. Each day seems like a natural fact. But what we think changes how we act. Change ideas, change is what we do.
Too much thinking makes me ill. I think I'll have another gin. A few more drinks, it'll be alright.
Each day seems like a natural fight. And what we think changes how we act.
We'll be right back.
like a natural fact. Each day seems like a natural fact. Each day seems like a natural fact. Each day seems like a natural fact.
And that word from the Gang of Four. And we're back on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and on the web at WBAI.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. My guest today, Joseph Stiglitz, author of Globalization and Its Discontents. I haven't mentioned the publisher, but I should. It's W.W. Norton, recently published and moving off the shelves in certain bookstores, at least. Joseph Stiglitz is also a professor of economics at Columbia University, former chief economist at the World Bank, and winner of the one of several winners of the 2001 Nobel Prize in Economics. And let's talk a bit about that the mentality of the IMF. What do they think they're doing? I mean, what do people there? How do they conceive of what they do? I mean, are they just applying principles they learned in economics classes? The standard critique is that they just, you know, one size fits all cookie cutter approach for any country at any time. You know, there's a given set of four or five policy proposals, and they should adopt them, and that's really all you need to know. Is their thinking really that that mechanical and crude?
Almost. The fact is that the way the IMF is organized is designed for people to be interchangeable parts. They don't want it to be the case that if you send economist X to a country, they give different advice than economist Y. So whatever you are, whoever you are, when you go into the country, there is an IMF formula. And the only way to have an IMF formula basically is to have a close to one size fits all, with decisions, recommendations, policies very tightly controlled from the center, from Washington, as opposed to people who really know the country in the field. The people in the bank, in the fund, in the IMF, actually, of course, believe that they're doing the right thing. You know, I think that they believe that they are enhancing global economic stability, that they are bringing needed advice to countries, that they are an important check against what they would call populist policies, that they are bringing economic virtue to those that really don't understand economic virtue. The problem is that the world has become quite complicated, and textbook economics typically doesn't work. In particular, textbook economics, often of the kind that's taught in the United States and UK, focuses on economies in which markets work very well. But in most developing countries, which is where the real focus of the activities of the IMF has been, in developing countries, markets don't work well. Information is imperfect. Competition is imperfect. Markets are incomplete. And unfortunately, that kind of world is not the kind of world that they studied. It is the kind of world that George Akerlof and I spent, you know, 30 years studying, markets in which information is imperfect. And there are some very important results that have come out of that research. For instance, one of them is to recognize the limitations of markets, that they often don't work well. As I sometimes put it, one of the things that our research showed was that the reason the invisible hand is invisible is partly that it's simply not there, that free markets do not necessarily lead to efficient resource allocations, and they certainly don't in general lead to kinds of distribution of income that lead to social and political stability. So the problem is in part that the world that the IMF economists are working in is not the kind of world that many of the IMF economists studied when they're in graduate school. As an example of that, the typical macroeconomic model that was taught in graduate school when the IMF economists were doing their graduate work, ignored the possibility of bankruptcy. It's a kind of world in which firms don't go bankrupt. But in East Asia, bankruptcy was at the center of the problem. When you don't think about bankruptcy, you get some very, very bad results. For instance, the IMF forced these countries to raise interest rates to really exorbitant levels.
Now, when you say bankruptcy, do you mean disaster and failure, or do you mean a process for sorting out debts and restructuring?
What I mean is the following, that if you have firms that are highly leveraged, have a lot of debt, and you raise interest rates to very high levels, they can't meet those debt obligations. And technically the word is that they go into distress. And when they can't meet their debt obligations, there are all kinds of consequences because they can't borrow, they can't get funds, they have to reduce their production, they have to lay off workers, and there's a vicious downward spiral in the economy.
Now, how can these folks not even think of bankruptcy as a possibility? I mean, all you have to do is read a newspaper, and it's there every day.
They're macroeconomists, and it's not in the macroeconomic model. And I
even though it is in the newspaper, it's not in the model.
It's not in the model. And I found it astounding. But, you know, to give you one example, they said that when you raise the interest rates, it makes it more attractive for capital to come into a country. And that supports the exchange rate.
But if everybody's going bankrupt, then capital's not going to go anywhere near the country.
Exactly. It's going to flee out of the country. And when that happens, the exchange rate will not be supported. And that's what happened over and over again in East Asia. And it was perfectly predictable. And they paid absolutely no attention to these predictions.
Well, after that crisis, there was a lot of talk, coming from the IMF, from the Treasury, from a lot of our pundits in the press, that the problem with Asia was crony capitalism and that they needed American-style transparency and modes of corporate governance. Of course, we're now learning that American corporations aren't anywhere near as well-governed or as transparent as we thought they were. What's happened to the prestige of this American model internationally? You do a lot of traveling and talking to people internationally.
Well, it had already been eroded by a couple of other things that the United States had done even earlier. For instance, in 1998, the U.S. government bailed out – not the U.S. – the U.S. government orchestrated a privately financed bailout of the long-term capital management after they had said that don't worry about hedge funds. They're too small to cause even a small country to have a problem. A year later, when their friends at long-term capital management were in difficulty, they said, oh, this failure of one firm could cause global financial instability, enormous change in mindset. As another example, they began by saying there's a problem with transparency, and the rest of the world said, yes, okay, we'll do something about it, but you know, half transparency isn't going to do any good. We have to have transparency in offshore banking centers and hedge funds, and all of a sudden, Larry Summers and the U.S. Treasury changed their tune. They said, well, we're not sure that we meant that kind of transparency. We meant transparency in East Asia. And then Secretary O'Neill vetoed the initiative of the OECD to force more transparency in the offshore banks.
The transparency seems to go one way.
Right before September 11th, right before it was then discovered that these offshore banking centers were the vehicles through which terrorists were getting funded. And at that point, of course, again, the U.S. Treasury changed its stand. Throughout the world today, the United States is viewed as being an advocate of hypocrisy. And, of course, it would be bad enough if we were just in this realm, but there are other areas which have reinforced that, the fact that it preaches free trade. Tells countries to get rid of their subsidies. But then, just this year, we raised farm subsidies to the record level. We provided tariffs to protect our steel industry. We said, well, they needed the protections, but if our steel industry needs protection, the United States, with a low unemployment, a strong safety net, a strong economy, What do the poorest countries of the world say where they have high unemployment, no safety nets? If the United States needs safeguards, they say they surely do.
Well, let's talk about protection for a second. Protection was an important part of U.S. industrial strategy in the 19th century. We protected our infant industries. East Asia, Korea certainly did some protectionism of its own for its own industries. Additionally, there's been in the U.S. in the 19th and early 20th centuries, we stole foreign patents, violated other countries' intellectual property rights. These strategies, which proved successful in the past, protectionism and intellectual property theft, are pretty much off limits now to any poorer country. I mean, what worked for the United States is now forbidden for Brazil and India. What do you think of that?
Well, I can tell you, you asked me before, what is the perception in the rest of the world? And what you hear in a lot of the rest of the world is the feeling that the United States, having done so well, is now pulling up the ladder after itself to make sure nobody else can climb up. I think, though, that the big issues are the following, that if we had a fair intellectual property regime, one that balanced the concerns of users as well as producers, the concerns of those that need drugs in the developing world, I think that the developing countries today could learn to live with that. If we had a regime that, for instance, that did not tolerate biopiracy, again, I think, you know, if it were viewed as a fair regime, I think attitudes would be markedly different than they are. But I was in the Clinton administration when there was a discussion of the TRIPS, that's the trade-related intellectual property provision, the provision in the work right round that regulates intellectual property. And both the Council of Economic Advisors and the Office of Science and Technology Policy believed that the kind of intellectual property regime that was being pushed by the U.S. Trade Representative, reflecting the perspectives of the pharmaceutical companies and the entertainment industry, was not balanced. We actually thought it would actually not be even good for research and innovation in the United States. Because as academics, for instance, we're users of knowledge. And excessive intellectual property protection, unbalanced intellectual property protection, can actually slow the pace of innovation. And I think that's what's happened.
Well, you'd almost think that they're not trying to encourage innovation, but to protect Merck and Intel and Time Warner, right?
I think there, as I said, it was very clear at the time that these intellectual property issues were being discussed that it was those interests that dominated American policy making.
I'm divided between wanting to ask you questions about your book and also to comment on current affairs, but I think people who want to know what's in the book can buy it. Globalization is Discontents by Joseph Stiglitz, just published by Norton. But let me ask you, I think I'd rather ask you about some things that are going on in the world now. Very considerable economic crisis in much of Latin America going on right now. Argentina is just deep crisis. That's not an exaggeration to use that word there. Brazil is teetering on the edge. Uruguay teetering on the edge. What do you think is happening there?
Well, part of it is it used to be said that when the United States caught a cold, when the United States sneezed, Mexico caught a cold. Today, with greater globalization, when the United States sneezes, much of the rest of the world, and Latin America in particular, not only catches a cold, but gets the flu or something worse. And that's part of what is going on. But there's another part that's going on, and what we're seeing is some of the consequences of full capital market liberalization. We saw it in East Asia, and now we're seeing it in Latin America. When investors' sentiment changes, as it can overnight, we see in the stock market that there can be excessive exuberance and irrational pessimism. And that kind of volatility we can withstand in the United States. But many of the poorer countries...
So far.
But many in the poorer countries cannot. So when investors decide this is not the place to have your money, they start pulling their money out, and there's a crash. Now, in the 97 crisis, the IMF and the U.S. Treasury said, oh, don't worry about it. As long as you have good policies, you won't have the problem. We knew that wasn't true. And in fact, the problems in Argentina actually began in 97, because here was the A-plus student of the IMF. The IMF kept praising Argentina. And the crisis...
Now, of course, they're trying to blame Argentina for their problems in retrospect. Yeah, but in fact, they were getting A-plus grades all along.
They were getting A-plus grades all along. And all of a sudden, the market said, we don't like any emerging markets, A-plus or worse, and forced Argentina to pay high interest rates. Argentina did not have heavy debt. Its debt-GDP ratio was around, even at the end, of around 55% at that time, was even lower. Gives you a comparison, it's far lower than the United States' debt-GDP ratio was in 92. Its deficit, even when it went into at the point of the crisis, was only 3%. The U.S. deficit-to-GDP ratio was 4.9%. And all of the deficit in Argentina was due to the privatization of Social Security. If the United States had privatized Social Security in 1992, our deficit to GDP ratio would have been 8%. So in terms of, as a point of comparison, Argentina should not have been blamed. But the point is that markets are fickle, and when they decide they want to pull their money out, no country, no matter how good, can survive the situation.
And what about Brazil? I mean, that's teetering on the edge now. There was the headline number is a $30 billion IMF package the other day. It doesn't seem to have had the magic effect on investor confidence that it was supposed to have. The amounts being disbursed are smaller than the $30 billion headline number. But what's your prognosis for Brazil?
Well, there are some fundamental differences between Brazil and Argentina, for instance, and many other cases where the IMF has added programs. In the case of Argentina, for instance, there was a vastly overvalued exchange rate. In the case of the IMF bailout of Brazil in 1998, there was an overvalued exchange rate. Today, Brazil probably has an undervalued exchange rate. In the case of Argentina, it was having trouble raising tax revenue. In the case of Brazil, ratio of tax revenue to GDP is comparable to that of advanced industrial countries. In the case of countries like Russia, where there have been an IMF program failed, there was a combination of a budget deficit, an overvalued currency, and a high level of corruption. The Brazilian government, central bank, has been a model of transparency. And this government has actually done some remarkable things. So I think there are some fundamental differences between Brazil today and the situations where the IMF previously has had bailouts. One of the problems, though, is that the IMF has not earned the confidence of the markets. Its bailouts have failed a very large percentage of the times. Its bailouts failed in Indonesia, in Korea, in Thailand, in Russia, in Argentina, and in Brazil in 98.
Now, the argument is that Asia has more or less recovered, and they would have been worse off without the IMF intervention. Do you agree with this idea that Asia's recovered?
Well, what I agree with is Korea, in fact, quickly recovered, and so did Malaysia. Malaysia's downturn was the shortest and the shallowest. Malaysia had no IMF program.
And they had capital controls for a period.
And they had capital controls. And as a result of that, they were left with a less legacy of debt than any of the other countries. Korea recovered quite quickly, but I would argue largely because they did not follow the dictates of the IMF. The IMF said, get rid of your chip industry. It was the resurrection, it was the recovery of the chip industry that was led the recovery of Korea. If the problems in Korea had been anywhere near the nature of the structural problems that the IMF had said, do you believe that in 6-7 months the country could have recovered like that? Clearly not. On the other hand, Thailand, the country that was the best student in some ways of the IMF is just now getting back to its income before the crisis. And Indonesia, the IMF doesn't like to talk about Indonesia, but it's still not back to where it was. The fact is that the IMF policies, its excessively contractionary policies, and its cutting off of food subsidies, just the critical point, led to the political and social turmoil that had such a devastating effect. The way it managed the financial restructuring led to a run on the bank. So the problems of the political and social turmoil are, to a large extent, of the IMF's making. And it can't simply say, oh, those are problems that weren't due to us. It helped create that situation.
And actually, a friend of mine in Russia asked me to ask you what you think of the signs of economic recovery in Russia over the last couple of years. Do you believe it, or is this just some anomaly or temporary factors?
Well, that's another interesting case. It wasn't until 98 and the devaluation which resulted from the crisis, which the IMF had opposed, that growth began. It wasn't until the default that growth began. So it was when the country finally put aside the IMF that it began actually to grow. Now, the devaluation combined with high oil prices did provide a stimulus to the economy, and it did grow quite robustly for a couple of years. It has now slowed. I think that the magnitude of the decline, you know, a decline of 40% in 8 years was enormous, so that the likelihood of recovery, of growth finally beginning to restore from this very low base, I think was I won't say inevitable, but there certainly were some strong reasons given the strong natural resource base of the economy. But there's some real fundamental problems. There are just some recent articles that have indicated that the level of industrial concentration in Russia is unbelievable, that something between 6 and 8 industrial conglomerates control something like 85% of the industrial base of the country. If that's the case, it's not the kind of competitive market economy that most of us think is the basis of a strong future for any country.
And one other question kind of related to Russia. Your former boss at the World Bank, James Wolfensohn, praised Cuba a little while ago for its success in getting good social indicators. Do you share his evaluation, and what do you think is behind that?
Well, I think Cuba has done a great deal for education and health. And what it has shown is that it is possible, even in a very poor country, to have a pro-poor growth strategy that improves health and education. And the failure to do that is simply because there has not been enough emphasis on these very important social dimensions of economic policy.
But the fact that Cuba has nothing to do with the IMF and is not under the influence of international capital markets, is that one of the reasons they're able to do these things, that other countries under the influence of these malign institutions really can't get away with it?
Well, I think that there are other countries that have taken other policies that have shown, you know, say other ways of becoming independent. For instance, China has also emphasized education a great deal and has not had an IMF program and has had the fastest record of economic growth and the most dramatic reduction.
And also isolated from world capital markets.
Well, that's a very interesting example, because they have not opened themselves to the short-term capital flows, the speculative capital flows that have brought with it instability, but they have invited foreign direct investment in, the kind of investment that leads to job creation and long-term economic growth. So that is an example of taking advantage of globalization, but on their own terms. And it's the countries that have followed willy-nilly the advice of the IMF that have wound up suffering.
All right, then let's. We've only got a few minutes left, but let's close with the Lenin question. What is to be done? The IMF now, I think it's pretty hard to say that it's anything but a disaster. I mean, its star pupils are all down in flames right now, it's not even able to have any kind of psychological magic now in announcing some kind of arrangement with Brazil. What kind of rejiggering of this institutional architecture would you think would serve the poor of the world better?
Well, one of the aspects of globalization is that the countries of the world are today more integrated. They're more interdependent. And with more interdependence, there is greater need for collective action, a greater need as a result for international institutions to regulate in one way or another trade, finance, to provide humanitarian assistance. The problem is that some of the institutions we have are not democratic, they're not transparent, they reflect special interests within the more advanced industrial countries. They do not represent the concerns of the poor and the developing countries. Now, I used to say that since we are going to need these institutions, it is better to reform them than to start from scratch. I'm beginning to have second thoughts. I'm beginning to ask, has the credibility of the IMF been so eroded that maybe it's better to start from scratch? Is the institution so resistant to learning, to change, to becoming a more democratic institution that maybe it is time to think about maybe it's time to think about creating some new institutions that really reflect today's reality, today's greater sense of democracy. When the IMF was founded more than 50 years ago, most of the developing countries were still third world countries. We had a fixed exchange rate system. The world has changed enormously, and perhaps now, some 50 years afterwards, it's really time to re-ask the question, should we reform or should we build from start?
I'm afraid we'll have to end it there. I've been speaking with Joseph Stiglitz, author of Globalization and Its Discontents, a book recently published by Norton, and a professor of economics at Columbia, former chief economist of the World Bank, and a thorn in the side of the IMF. Thank you for joining us, Joseph Stiglitz. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news. And programming note, next week, roundtable on World Trade Center reconstruction. What should happen with downtown Manhattan? Till next week, goodbye.